Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
This is the Wheel of Time Spoilers Podcast.
Yeah, so welcome back to What Spoilers, doubleheader today because winter's hard.
it's like eating a chocolate chip cookie and all you want is the chocolate chips. There's a lot there, but that you've got to eat to get to the good parts. But there are good parts in there.
Yeah, so we've managed to scrape up a few good parts for you good listeners today, but it took us two chapters to do it, so... Welcome to chapters 28 and 29.
News in a cloth sack.
Weird title. What do you think it means? Because I was like, it's kind of the Adam literally, but also like a badger, because Matt's kind of like a badger. Think of what goes in cloth sacks.
See, I was thinking of the Tarvalin After Dark mail sack.
Oh.
Because he's thinking with his mail sack in this chapter quite a bit.
Names will appreciate that.
But yeah, I think, you know, like a cloth sack is sort of the one that's like, you know, it's like someone in a burlap sack. It's like the worst possible news that you could get. But, you know, I don't know. I'm totally bullshitting right now. I really have no idea where that title comes from.
I mean, it's the very end of the chapter. It's like a thing that's visually there at the end of the chapter. Like, Matt gets good news of a sort in a cloth sack. But I find it a much less satisfying title than the next chapter's title.
Because, okay, so in the chapter, the cloth sack is the sack that contains the two dresses wound around the silver Adam, right? But yet they don't need them, right?
Well, they need the Adam for Jolene. All the dresses and stuff become moot, but the Adam they need.
Well, he does say, I need three Suldam, so I assumed each Suldam will bring their own Adam, but maybe not. That's a good point.
Yeah, there's a lot of plans getting scratched out in this.
Right, exactly.
Section.
Right. It seems like every time they receive something, it gets revised and changed, and they've done a bunch of work for nothing.
Yeah,
so that's what
yeah.
it seems to me. Is it seems to represent doing a bunch of work for nothing and spinning your wheels, basically.
And how does that relate to the harp that is our chapter logo?
Because we've got Tom in this one, and he's the one helping to gather the news. I think, you know, one refers to Julian, one refers to Tom. I think they do that a lot sometimes, where if the title refers to one of the major, I'm putting that in big quotes, things are going on with one of the characters, they'll take the chapter icon and refer it to the other.
Hmm. All right, cool. And also the other thing with these two chapters going together is that we're covering about a 9-day period. First chapter is basically days 1 through 8. Mm-hmm. And then the second chapter is like the little bit of the end of day 8 and all of day 9 rolling into the morning of day 10. That's the period that we're going to be covering today in this episode.
So yeah, it's really just touching on this, the time when Tylin is gone. Well, her leaving and her being gone. So there's a reason why it felt like a cohesive whole is because it is all just one continuous timeline and week that happens. It also is one of the few places that we verify that a week is 10 days because he says she'll be gone for a week. And then later he says he's got 10 days till she comes back.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
yeah. Again, this all starts with Tylin leaving, which Tuon suggested.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes me think that she wanted Tylan out of the way to see what Matt would do when he had some independence and had some space on his own.
Absolutely nodding. I had the exact same mm-hmm. thought as I was doing my notes. Like, this is 100% orchestrated because she suspects that Matt is the man who will marry her and carry her away.
Right.
So she figures he can't do much carrying me away and doing whatever omen-tastic shit he needs to do for me if Tylan is here bogging the whole situation down. If I get Tylan out of the way, maybe I'll find out what this whole carry me away thing is about.
Exactly. Also, I think she just wants to see who he is, right? Because he's been Tylan's toy this whole time. What if he's not Tylan's toy anymore? Who is he?
Yeah, she has a lot of reasons for doing this, and none of it is an accident. This is not her idle curiosity. This is very calculated on her part. And I think part of why she handles her kidnapping so calmly is because she's like, oh, this is what that prophecy meant. That makes sense. Cool, cool, cool. But yeah, she's setting that up here.
So we open on a scene with Matt in bed with Tylan, right? And there's a few bits in this chapter that make me think, no matter how their relationship has started, Matt has come to care for Tylan quite a bit.
Yeah, for sure. He's become naturalized to the situation or something.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. For one thing, he's talking about how fair her skin is. You know, it's the fairest he's ever touched. When she leaves, he's like, and I had to stay there waving until she was completely out of sight, even to the telescope. And it's like, you had to, did you? I don't think you did.
See, I always thought of that one as being part of more of the where he's really performing for her and the part where he keeps thinking about her and sleeping in her bed and thinking about her skin. Like, I saw a lot of like mixed stuff coming from him in this chapter where he still like reflexively resents what's happening, but also he's become quite accustomed to it. Mm-hmm. And so like the doc thing I was chalking up to him being overly paranoid about managing her, mm-hmm. but also it feels a little overdone. So I don't know, maybe you're right.
Yeah, I think you're giving Jordan too much credit there. I think that he's writing it as though Matt has come to actually like her, but is still reflexively saying, oh, I don't actually like this. Oh, I don't. You know, in the same way that he says, I'm not a hero, but actually is. He keeps saying, oh, I hate this. I hate this. I hate this. When in reality, he's actually come to like it quite a bit.
Yeah, he's confusing me. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, and this is Matt is a very unreliable narrator when it comes to his own relationships. It's very hard to tease out what he's actually thinking because he denies what he's actually thinking.
Yeah.
And that's a theme from Matt for a long time, you know, like, I'm not just making that up for these chapters. That's something we've talked about for him for ages and ages and ages.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I also love the slight foreshadowing here as he's talking mm-hmm. with her about the rocket. He's like, I think I would actually like flying on one of those things. And it's like, yeah, you're going to get your chance. you are going to rock your one opportunity to fly on one of those things. You're going to do absolutely as good as you think. It's going to be great.
The other foreshadowing I like is when Tuon says, shall I tie you to the bed so I know you'll be safe till I return?
Oh,
because yeah. He ties her to the bed, and that's what gets her killed.
Yeah, that's a rougher foreshadowing than his than his joyride on a rockin'. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, mm-hmm. And in so many ways, she brings it upon herself. So it's very appropriate that she deliver a line foreshadowing her own demise.
Mm-hmm. And one other thing I noticed about that, too, is he's not sleeping in her bed right now, right? He knows that's somewhere where the golem could track him down, and he's actually been actively avoiding that bed. And it's not until he goes back and sleeps in that bed again that the golem comes back and finds the queen in it, right? It's because golem's tracking.
Is that on night 10?
I think so. Because she comes back on day 10. That's not in these two chapters, but she comes back on day 10, brings Matt in. He sleeps in the bed that one night. And then the golem, because he always sleeps in a different place every night. So the golem can come to where he was the night before.
Right, right, right. Yeah. So because at the end of our two chapters today, he spends the night in her bed for the first time in a week. His attempt to protect himself, and he does so much to protect Tylan, so that's what makes it really rough, right? Because he does a lot in these chapters, even to the point of inconveniencing himself quite significantly, to protect her.
Politically.
That's so rough that strategy ends up also sealing her fate. Oof.
Mm-hmm. Well, she came back early. He ruined his plans.
This is true. Yeah. He had a very complicated plan as far as timing goes, and that was his mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've learned from these books that complicated plans are doomed to fail, and he simplified a lot, but not the timeline.
Yeah, although he does say he had 10 days, maybe less, and it was less. It was 9 days, yeah. An interesting bit about Matt's memories. He's trying to keep the horses under control, and he says, Matt's skill, well, all the skill that had somehow come with those other men's memories to keep the animal in hand. And I thought that was interesting, because I thought Matt was a really good writer independently of those other men's memories. But it's obvious, like, they've kicked him up a notch into, like, an excellent writer, because a lot of these people were, you know, field cavalry.
Yeah, I'm guessing, too, that, like, his innate skill with horses was, like, an innate skill with horses, whereas what he got from the memories is, like, how to have battle commands for a horse and how to have, like, that, like you said, like, it's an upgrade. Just being good with horses as people versus being good with horses as tools of war is two subtly different skill sets.
I have a question here. He's thinking about going with Luca's show, and he says he had a notion of how to make the man leave before spring if it came to that. A dangerous notion, maybe, but he did not see much choice. Any idea what that notion is to get him moving?
My only idea is a form of blackmail based on stuff he knows about Luca through Tom and Julin, but I couldn't think of specifically what. Just some sort of nefarious, I'll tell on you in XYZ way to ABC authority.
Maybe you aided some Aes Sedai back in the day?
Exactly. Right. Something like that. Some very dangerous, are you going to call my bluff because we'll both go down if you do? Like, kind of.
Right.
And that's why it's so dangerous, is he's just like, I know enough to, like, get into a game of chicken with this guy, basically. That's the best I got.
That's better than anything I came up with.
I love how the Blood are thinking that they're going to be sleeping rough with only the number of servants that they're taking with them. It's just such a fun, like, they are so pampered. Mm-hmm. It's so, like, Court of the Sun King levels of nonsense. Like,
yeah, a little ridiculous.
It's fun.
I mean, how many servants they brought with them across the sea, right? I can only imagine these spoiled, pampered nobles on tiny ships packed with everything.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't care how big a ship is. It's tiny.
By definition, yes.
So, yeah. Oh, God, that crossing must have been miserable. Did the ships, like, get together and exchange passengers, where there was, like, flotillas? I always wonder about stuff like that. How do you stay together? How do you make sure you don't lose somebody? How do you, you know, how do you link up at night so you can, like, jump between ships and, like, see other people? You know, like, what's the protocol for a flotilla of ships crossing a large sea that takes months?
I have no idea. I know flotillas have done it, so clearly there is a protocol, but I don't have the foggiest idea of how that works. A lot of flag signaling.
Yeah, I bet.
That's
what
the flags. Flag stuff is all about. But in an age with the One Power and all the cool technological advancements that our characters and Shan Chan have, like, who knows? They might be well beyond the flag stage.
Right, because you can imagine that's where the skylights were developed.
Oh,
right?
Totally. Yeah, visual Morse code. Totally. Mm-hmm. Or just, you know, voice amplification weaves or whatever. And probably an entire flotilla of attendant ships just for the backup servants, because there's not enough room on, like, right, the actual main house flotilla.
Now I'm picturing two nobles on two different ships yelling, "Can you pass the salt?" Somehow, like, opening gateways and teleport. Well, I guess that wouldn't happen in Shan Chan, but, like, somehow using the power to, like, throw salt back and forth between the two ships.
Only when they get lost and have to ration stuff.
Right.
I need some potted quail's eggs. I'm just saying they would.
Three of my servants have died from gangrene. I need a few more.
Definitely. Ugh. Definitely.
Speaking of servants, we get a view of Pura, who used to be Rima Galfrey, who we saw in The Great Hunt. And it's been over a year since she was taken, and she is completely broken.
Yep, she is gone and replaced.
Yeah, Pura is somebody else. And it's... It's such a weird thing, and it's one of those things that you're like, only in fantasy, but maybe not.
Well, there is magic involved in this one, so it's easy to say this is just a, you know, the whole like anecdote about a, you know, Doc Hovale running to fetch the instrument of his own punishment. That's in the realm of, is it fantasy or is it real life? At least with the Aes Sedai, there's magic grinding into their brains on top of it. So we can comfortably say that is only, this level is only in fantasy. What's good? But there's also an anecdote right next to it of a non-channeler being the same way. So like,
In which case I always come back to the Crystal Throne being a compulsion device.
Mm-hmm.
That you will obey the throne and all the commands, you know, down from there. And anyone who may be royal servants, I'm sure, could maybe be influenced. I don't know. I love the idea, in case you haven't heard, of the Crystal Throne being a compulsion device. And that's where the power of the Crystal Throne actually comes from, is the throne itself being a compulsion device for non-channelers, a binding chair.
Another comment about how trade is still going because merchants are unscrupulous cutthroats.
That leads Matt to think about Rand and get the color swirl.
Is it really interesting, note, when all of them are getting into the boat, the Suldam help the Damani into the boat. Like, in so many cases, you know, the servants help the nobility, the low nobility help the high nobility, the whole thing. The leash holders help the leashed. Seems like an odd reversal of that pattern of the lower person helping the higher person into the boat. Maybe because they're such delicate tools, they can't be dropped?
No, it's like you lift your dog's butt into the car, right? Like,
well, because the dog is so much smaller than me.
Right, I know. But I feel like that's sort of what he's going for, is this idea that, like, they're animals who aren't capable of taking care of themselves, and so their needs need to be constantly tended by their caretakers.
Ugh, you're probably right. We get a note that all the surviving Atha on Meyer are in the most hard manual backbreaking labor.
Mm-hmm.
They're being punished as a group for how unconquerable they are.
And I think that's a little foreshadowing where he says he owes them nothing. And immediately turns around him to thinking, oh, but if I did free them, there's a bit later on where he thinks about how you can't free the Suldam or the Damani. You can't free the Damani because they will just go right to the Suldam and they won't fight for you. But at the same time, he's thinking about the Atha on Meyer and how he doesn't owe them anything. It's like, wait, what if I just freed the Atha on Meyer? I bet they would fight back. Those Windfinders have the power and they have not been broken. Or at least I can go to one of them who can figure out who's been broken and who hasn't.
Right. And if we could maybe get a chain gang revolt, that would really tie up the Shan Chan and maybe break some people out of bondage, which would be good.
Right.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of Matt not realizing the ingredients he's going to actually need in the end at this point. You're seeing all the pieces that he ultimately picks up to make the plan work, but right now he's completely off working on a plan that will fail, like, entirely, and that's what he's focused on.
Yeah, this is more, you know, sneak in, sneak out, hope nobody notices plan. That's not what ends up happening. What ends up happening is more of stuff fireworks into a window and set them off and then try and climb through the hole while everybody comes pouring through.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, I can't imagine who else would have done something like that.
Chat's pointing out that your whole theory about the chair really supports why Tuon would want Rand not just to kneel in front of her symbolically, but literally in Shan Chan.
Right. Because if he kneels in front of the Crystal Throne, then he'll be compelled to obey the Crystal Throne. And the Dragon Reborn will be obeying the Crystal Throne.
Right. And he's like, but allegory. And she's like, but magic loophole technicality.
Right. But that makes sense as to why she's so convinced that once he swears to the Crystal Throne, he will be under her control. Is because the idea, if he swears to the Crystal Throne in Shan Chan, he will be compelled to do so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even if they're not conscious of that as a thing, it seems like they understand that no one who ever swears to the Crystal Throne breaks that oath.
Yeah, superstition can be right for the wrong reasons.
Yeah, and my idea was anyone who hears the voice of someone sitting on the Crystal Throne will be compelled to do whatever they say. So, for example, if there's a perhaps traditional prayer said in the beginning of court or something like that.
May she live forever.
Like, may she live forever, basically, right? That's all she has to do is hear the voice. And that's why, you know, all the nobles in Shan Shan use a voice that they sign to, is so that they can control when the compulsion is happening and when it's not. So you don't accidentally compel someone to do the wrong thing. So the whole point of a voice is to avoid the effects of the compulsion while you're sitting on the throne. And then everybody picked it up as a habit.
It's fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
So then Noel pops up. That's the next thing I've got. Is Noel being like, I require being in the main plot, please.
I have a book written about me and everything. Actually, he wrote the book, so.
Yeah.
And this is sort of an author insert, isn't it? If the Travels of Jane Farstrider is Robert Jordan's like adventure book insert about, which is the Wheel of Time, then the author insert would be Noel.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, I recognize cool people who are going to do cool stuff, and I would like to be near them. And it's funny, too, because he thinks he's offering to help Matt get out of the palace, and he doesn't really help. He comes along. He helps, kind of, but what he's really signing up for, the thing that he really is needed for, is rescuing Moraine.
Right.
That's the real thing that's pulling him to attach himself to Matt, is because Moraine's rescue will not work without him. So if he isn't with Matt's party, none of that's going to work. So the reason that he's like, I got to be with this guy, the reason in his conscious mind and the reason in his Tavirin pulling, very, very different.
And I think it was always going to be him. You know, I know Moraine says you and Tom and a third, I don't know who. And I don't think that's not because she didn't see him. I think that's because she never met Noel and was like, yeah, there's a third dude there. I don't know who.
Yeah, it might also have been like something fuzzy about him because he tells so many stories, has so many names. Maybe like the vision was like, he's a little blurry around the edges, but he's a good dude. And she's just like, whatever, I trust it. Matt and Tom are good enough to vet for whoever this third person is. I don't need to fret myself.
I also have to wonder if there was some risk of whether or not he was going to be able to break away from the compulsion and the like, the stuff that Ishmael and Grendel have done to him. And so, like, maybe he was just going to report back to them, and he would have continued to be a spy and wouldn't have helped out, and they would have had to have somebody else.
Right, and Matt's got a lot of people who could have attempted to fill what Noel does, being a badass fighter who's willing to stay behind so the rest of the team can get out. Like, he's got five or six people I could name that could volunteer for that and give as good as they got in that role. I don't know that any of them would have succeeded, but certainly, like,
Vannon, Bail Domon,
Harnan, maybe?
Harnan's
kind of smart. Mm-hmm. Okay, maybe there's only three. And I don't know that Domon would volunteer for what would probably be a suicide mission, but I was thinking Vannon in particular would be like, fuck it, it's for Lord Matt, and like...
Right, right.
But...
Also, he's Demandred, so...
Right, and he's Demandred, so it would be perfect.
Right. So, one by one, basically, through this chapter, all of Matt's alternative escape routes are being cut off. And so, every time he's like, well, I guess I'm stuck with Luca. Can't use Talanon's ships, right?
Nope, he gets that cut off. She's like, I already sent those out of town. They're, like, long gone.
He can't rent any ship because of the Suldan patrolling the docks. So, basically, they're inspecting all the cargo that aren't Shan Shan ships. So, yeah, there's just... He's like, shoot, overland is the only way I'm going to be able to make it out of here.
Right. Oh, did you also notice the foreshadowing for Shara? Noel mentions Shara, and it's like, women who can channel have tattooed faces and are going to fuck off the last battle!
But this, where we bring up, okay... If you bring up the tattooed faces, 300 crimes carried a penalty of death, and giants lived under the mountains. Men taller than Ogier with the faces on their bellies.
I got nothing.
Yeah.
They're a thing that presumably exists.
I just wonder if it's somehow a twisting of a rumor of something else that's there.
I mean, I feel like there's some reference somewhere in old-timey literature about people with their faces in their bellies, so...
There is, and we've talked about it before on the podcast. We've looked it up, and it's totally a thing that, like, existed, and there's a lot of theories about why they were called that way. There was, like, a specific ethnicity of people who sort of had, like, short necks, and, like... I remember there being all sorts of reasons why... the myth of people with their heads in their bellies existed. There's a whole study about it.
Interesting. So yeah, I'm assuming that that's a real thing in Shara that we just never get to see.
Right.
I'm assuming it's not a myth because we know that the tattooed face channelers and tons of capital punishment, we know both of those things are true. Oh, we've got a wiki article called Headless Men. Anyway, not as relevant as the fact that the Golem is back, which is the far more important news that Noel is bringing us.
Oh, yes. The bloodless bodies everywhere.
Yeah, this is the beginning of a serial killer streak that ends with the Seekers being very upset and being prepared to go after, you know, interrogate anybody, find this criminal, because it's basically a serial killer on the loose as far as they're concerned. And, like, their internal secret police are like, what? This is not appropriate.
So why do you think the Golem is killing so many people and not coming after Matt?
I think it's trying to drive him out. Because think about it. Matt is trying to slip away, and it's going to get harder the tighter the Seanchan patrols are. So if the Golem makes the Seanchan much more difficult for Matt to escape, Matt will be more likely to end up in a position where the Golem can get to him. Very convoluted, but that's the best I got, is that the Golem is trying to increase the heat and the pressure on Matt's situation.
So you think he's killing people basically to say, come and get me, or I'll keep killing? Or is it more of, hey, I'm hungry and these are and frustrated and these are victims of opportunity?
Well, I mean, definitely he's hungry and frustrated and these are victims of opportunity. But I think that the part where the Seanchan secret police get involved and start increasing security, I think is a desirable outcome because it knows Matt's trying to get away, right? And Matt is doing his best to stay where the Golem can't get to him. I guess it doesn't really know what Matt's, like, specific motivations are. But Matt's doing a good job of avoiding it. And so it's definitely frustrated, for sure.
And it might not even know where Matt is, right? Because he encountered him in the Riad.
In the Riad and in this side of the city. That was when he met Noel. It was not in the Riad. It was near the Terrace and Palace, kind of. I assume that it knows where he lives.
You think, because can't it track by smell and stuff like that?
Yeah.
It should be able to just, yeah. So, it just confused me as to why it was just sort of putzing around in the outer part of the city and not just coming after Matt wherever he was.
Oh, because it's supposed to avoid notice and it's pissed off. So it's venting its spleen, I guess. It doesn't have a spleen. But yeah, or maybe it is thinking that it can draw Matt out by killing a bunch of innocents and that will work. And then when that doesn't work, it like changes tactics.
The other thing I thought is maybe after its last fight, it got burned a couple of times. It's possible that it's trying to heal by consuming a lot of blood.
They live on blood, and it needs to heal, and you need more food when you're healing. So that would make sense.
Mm-hmm. And the Golem does need sustenance. The question is how much, not necessarily... Like, eventually they will starve to death. Like, that has been established.
It would take centuries, though, probably.
Possibly. You know, we don't really know how much blood they need to survive. Or what the rate... That's, like, the only one that survives was in a stasis box.
Yeah.
Where we assume, essentially, no time passed for it. So, you know, I remember the article, 50 Ways to Kill a Golem. One of them was, like, stick it in a sealed box and just wait for it to starve to death.
Yeah. Yeah, the next thing I brought is, Tuon is staring at him because reasons we already talked about. We get a timeline check.
Right, that's the whole point of her sending Surat the way, so she could follow him around and stare at him and see what he's up to.
Yeah, see what he does, but he's got a little less oversight. And then we get one of his most iconic lines. Maybe a little lace. Just a little. He's getting to dress himself, right? The chapter opens with Tylan dressing him in really aggressive clothes, and he's, you know, overcorrecting and bouncing back to plain clothes, and He feels like maybe he overcorrected a little bit much, and maybe just a little lace. Like, this is one of those iconic Matt things, and here it is on page 540 of the hardcover.
Just a little lace. Just a little. Because he gets a plain blue coat. I mean, it's still probably the best cut, highest quality material. Probably fits him like a glove, you know? It's probably looks like a super high class coat to anybody else, but it doesn't have any lace on it.
No embroidery. It's downright somber if you really think about it. His Overton window, his window of tolerance has been so pushed.
Right, because like I bet this coat, even this fine blue wool coat, if Rand had been wearing that back in The Great Hunt, he would have made fun of him for
Absolutely.
It. And now he's like, this is too plain even for me.
Yeah. And Julin comes waltzing in, grinning ear to ear, because his lady love is in fact one of Surath's Dakovale, and in fact was not taken on this trip. And so he thinks he has a chance to spirit her away, and because he really loves her, it makes him happy.
And that's, of course, Almathera, a.k.a. Thera, the former Panarch of Amadisio, right?
Terabon.
Right, because Amadisio's white cloaks.
Yeah, so Julin has a bunch of hard tasks thrown at him, but he's a little bit on a cloud because Soroth's gone and he has a chance to get at Thera.
And I think Matt's taking advantage of that.
Oh,
he's
big
like,
time.
He's head over heels for this girl, so he'll do whatever I want.
Oh, yeah, he's thinking with a small head, I can get all kinds of things off my to-do list.
And that's what Matt asks him to steal something, which is, of course, he's the cop. And he's like, well, cops know how to steal stuff, you know? And Julian's like, fine.
Yes,
I do.
I love
but
it.
But yeah, that's great.
Like, I'm a thief catcher, not a thief. Matt's like, same, same, but different. And Julian's like, for the girl. Not for you, Matt. Right. For the girl. And so, yeah, then we get kind of a time montage in which the servants are all very much, let us hobble your attempts to get away because we don't appreciate what's happening here at all.
But he's not hiding his attempts to get away because he wants to protect Tylan, right? He wants it to be obvious that this is something he was planning long before she came back.
Yeah, and I think that's part of why the servants are so, like, in this game of whack-a-mole catch, you know, cat and mouse with him, is because he's leaning into it, and, like, maybe he's playing some of the, like, well, I wish someone would make me stay, but I'm really leaving, and, like, he's putting himself through a complete rigmarole in an effort to defuse the political bomb that he is setting off in his wake.
Meanwhile, he's trying to basically work on his injuries. He's trying to build up his stamina. He's finally healed, but he hasn't done a lot of work. And I've come back from that, like when I broke my jaw. There was a point where I'd healed, but I hadn't chewed food in like 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it took me more weeks of just literally like chewing and resting and chewing and resting and chewing and resting to the point where I could eat a meal without thinking about it again. He's doing rehab is basically what he's doing at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, he's putting himself through physical therapy. Mm-hmm. He sees Teslin, who's starting to look a little frayed around the edges because of that new training regime that we talked about a couple of chapters ago, where she's getting really erratic punishments and rewards. And so she's feeling her mind slipping a little bit and her identity slipping a little bit. And Matt's seeing that from the outside and assuming it's just women being impatient. But we know it's because the training is starting
getting
to work.
One person who's not there anymore, Anoth, a.k.a. Samaraj.
She's on retreat.
Is she doing?
She's having a spa week.
What is she bathing in?
Blood. I don't actually know what she's doing specifically, but definitely the excuse that she's given to the Shan Shan is she needs a spa week.
I mean, at this point, doesn't she have the sad bracelets?
Yes. Yes, she does.
So maybe she's hiding them somewhere, or
she's working on her plan to ultimately capture Rand. She's setting that up and doing some of the backstage work.
That would be my guess. Yeah, it's just or like reporting in.
Yeah, or managing some other plot. Yeah, I have no idea what she's doing here, but it's nefarious and it could definitely be related to what she does with the sad bracelets. Because that has not happened yet and won't happen for weeks in the timeline, right? Or is that like about to happen? When does that happen? Relative to Matt escaping Ebu Dar and Tumon.
When does what happen exactly?
Semirag attacking Rand.
That's super late. That's in Sanderson's books.
Okay, so that's not happening like right now.
No. Because that's the thing that, like, that's the last that can be done to him, right? Is the whole, like, strangling men.
No, getting the hand blasted off is, like, days before that. That's what I'm thinking of, is the meeting where she gets captured because she was trying to capture him. Like, the last that could be done is days after that.
Oh, yeah. But, like, so the meeting happens in Knife of Dreams, chapter 27. But then the last that can happen to him is in The Gathering Storm. So that's the first book of Sanderson's.
Yeah. So I just... But that's not what Semirog's doing now. She attacks Rand. She attacks Rand before Tuon returns.
Yes. So what she's doing now is, I think, is she's killing the entire Empress and the entire royal family.
Oh, that's what she's doing. She is currently regiciding the fuck out of Shan Shan.
Right. Because beginning of Knife of Dreams prologue... She has killed the Empress and their entire family.
Yep, that is what she's doing. And she's on retreat, right. Bathing in the blood of the Imperial family. You weren't even joking when you said, what is she bathing in? And I said, blood. That wasn't even a joke. I walked into that.
No, I wasn't joking. Mm. Yep. I was like, yep, she's off killing the royal family.
Yep, that makes sense. Yep.
And just because of the way timelines work and the fact that we go back in time a lot and, like, we don't actually find out about it till the Crossroads of Twilight or the Knife of Dreams prologue. We don't hear about it at all in Crossroads of Twilight, but that's okay because Crossroads of Twilight goes back in time. So,
okay.
And nothing ever happens in Crossroads.
Excellent. All right. Glad we sorted that out.
I'd look up Semirog's timeline to get that all sorted. So she's off killing the family right when Matt kidnaps Tuon, right? So those two things, she becomes Empress at the same time he's kidnapping her and when she marries him.
Wow.
So, yeah, all those, he basically becomes the Emperor the moment she marries him.
Wow. Well, the Prince of Ravens, but yeah. Mm-hmm. But he climbs the ladder very, very quickly on that one.
I love he's got a line. Women lied to get a man into bed, and they lied worse once they had him there. Okay, Matt. Pot calling the kettle black there.
Yeah, seriously. I also just, like, want to point out, like, this is the point that we should be taking away from this is that beauty standards are lies. Everyone is hot to someone. This whole, oh, I'm not very hot. It must be a lie if someone says, no, Matt, you are actually drop-dead gorgeous to some people. Like, that's just... Stop. There is no one beauty standard, Mr. Jordan.
We've seen Matt in the TV show. He's quite pretty.
Yeah, we've seen both Matts in the TV
show.
Both
Matts.
Like, yeah. Yeah. And it's just, you know, the idea that some people are ugly and not attractive is just like, it's so fantasy books. It's so unhelpful.
So they're trying to get this whole thing together. They need a signature from someone of the blood, which they can't seem to get. And also Tom can't get the right seal because they can't find anything to copy, basically.
Yeah, it's a fetch quest where they keep rolling natural ones.
Right, totally. It's like, I need these five things. And like 7 days later, they have none of them.
Yeah, just like that. It's a very ADHD moment too, where you're like, okay, I'm going to work on my project. Where's my pencil? And the next thing you know, you've done like half the laundry, disassembled like your bedroom, and you have not worked on your essay at all. It's like that. They run around trying to get a bunch of stuff, and pretty soon nothing has happened.
The only thing I will comment is they're trying to keep Beslan from rising up as part of this thing. And he does say, if we free the Demane along with the Aes Sedai, they will fight besides us. And of course, I think think that nudges Matt along into the freeing of the Sea Folk.
Right. I can't free the Aes Sedai or the regular Demane, but maybe the Windfinders would be the right mix. Yeah.
And they've only been under for 6 weeks since he fell under the wall.
Yeah, all of their conditioning is exactly as old as his leg being broken.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a whole bunch of Matt and Tom and Julin and Beslan whispering in corners and bouncing ideas off each other, which lead to things but are in and of themselves ultimately useless.
Right, because the solution, of course, comes with Bail Domon and Egyanen.
Which no one could have anticipated. Right.
Taviren at work right there, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Definitely, because Matt runs up against a wall and is like, how am I going to do the impossible? And it's do ex Domon, you know, or Domon ex Machina.
Domanus Machina. We're in trouble. Bail Domon to the rescue.
I mean, it's one of Jordan's favorite moves is just drop it Bail really Domon in. Bail Domon. Parachute our people out.
Yeah, he do be one of Jordan's favorites.
Yeah.
Rizal, we find out, is marrying Sean Chan. She's convinced with her large eyes that one of the Sean Chan has fallen for her.
Yep.
And she's marrying into power.
Yeah, basically. Yeah, she is. Assimilation is happening in Rizal's story. That is the beginning of the kind of assimilation that is much, much harder to undo when the invaders start marrying the locals, especially when it is at the locals' behest, because Rizal is the one leading that relationship. There is never any doubt that the Sean Chan is 100% just following along.
Oh, yeah. He's captured by the nose.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that is Ephraim Yamada, who is a banner general that reports to Captain General Galgan, and he just kind of stays in the ever-victorious army and is just kind of a decent mid-rank soldier that never does anything of interest, but gets mentioned like 5 times throughout the series.
Mm, okay.
And he buys her a vineyard or villa or something like that to go move out to. She doesn't have to be a barmaid anymore. Like, she sees this guy walk up and is like, and I'm giving my 2 weeks notice. We're done.
No more tutoring. I am ready to be a housewife.
Yeah, settling down suddenly looks like that's the moment for it. And yeah, so they're trying to figure out who can be the Dabani, and they think about Rizal, and Matt's like, ooh, she can do worse than say no. Hmm. Like, they've got information security as a real, real problem with this plot, too. Because same thing with, like, oh, can we get the Damani involved? And it's like, they can do worse than refuse to participate. Right. And, like, if you bring in a Damani who then is not going to participate, like, now you have to kill her for being a liability. Like, are you up to doing war crimes, Beslan? Are you up to the war crimes? And Beslan's like, no, not, but,
And they have a real problem with Soldom, because they think any woman, they're like, well, I'm just going to grab these 3 random women and they'll pretend to be Soldom, not realizing that you actually do need Soldom to wear the bracelets.
Yeah. Yeah. Which I'm a little confused why, because it seems like the patrolling Soldom Damani pairs wouldn't know the difference.
Well, it's because if you don't put a bracelet on a Soldom, the Damani can't go anywhere. They fall down sick. It's like putting it on a peg.
Oh, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Oh, I have always, always, always wondered what the fuck happens in the next chapter with Satala and Jolene. Why did I not put that together before? I'm so dense.
Yeah, she's magically inert. She's been stilled. It's might as well stick it on a peg. And so the Soldom walking with it is basically like pulling it off the peg and trying to walk away with it because there's no connection there. And so they get the same effect, the crampy, you know, vomiting thing that as if they were trying to escape by grabbing the other side of their leash and running with it.
I am as dense as an over-kneaded beginner loaf of bread made out of all whole wheat. This is ridiculous.
I've made a couple of those.
You know the dents I'm talking about.
Yes, yes.
I am that dense.
You can kill a badger with it, that's for sure.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm glad that scene makes sense now.
Before we get to it.
Oh, God, that's embarrassing.
He thinks he can get Amethyra, Satalanon, and Rizal to be his quote-unquote Soldom, which, of course, isn't going to work at all.
None of them. All 3 of those are duds.
All 3 of them are non-channelers at this point. And, frankly, Amethyra is not in an emotional state. I like Julen's way of describing, she's timid now. Oh, you mean has PTSD and shell-shocked from being in abusive custody of both the Black Aja and the Sean Chan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah,
timid, PTSD, same.
Same, yeah. Timid. Yeah.
The one thing we do know for sure about the plan, we're going to do it at night. That's one detail that doesn't fall through. They work out the intel. Right. It has to be at night. That stays the same.
Because otherwise, they'll have Soldom coming and going. They're left alone to sleep at night, so no guards. Because why would you need to guard them? They can't escape.
Exactly. There's a servant here named Narvin, who I wanted to be somebody, but he's not. He's just a one-off mention. I wanted to be like that servant that we know is like a dark friend or whatever from before, mm-hmm. but now it's not the same guy.
He could be a listener.
He's probably a listener, but he's not the guy that we had a note from before.
Yeah, no. And he is never mentioned again. Nice backstory, Jordan.
Yeah. Yeah. I love Tom's strategy for dealing with listeners here. Matt's like, so Tom says, oh yeah, if you know, the listeners are doing this and that, because he hears about the whole serial killer hunt thing. And Matt's like, you've been talking to listeners. What is in the crack brain tomfoolery? And Tom's like, dude, just assume everyone's a listener. It's very simple.
And I figured out two or three who actually are listeners, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that Narvin is trying to listen in, and then a sentence later, Jordan says, assume everybody's a listener. I think he's trying to say this person was a listener.
Totally, totally. I can buy that, no problem.
So yeah, the golem strikes again, which finally everyone puts together that there's been a bunch of bloodless bodies turning up. This is how vampire myths get started. And the seekers have been ordered to go out and find whoever is doing the killings and stop them.
And garlic prices are going through the roof right now.
Everyone's buying this cross, even though they have no idea what it represents.
Yeah, for some reason, silver jewelry is really popular right now.
Right, right, right. Yeah, yeah.
And his leg is getting better. Yay, physical therapy is good if you follow through with it every day.
Just adding a little more stamina, right? It's just, it's basically any trainer will tell you, you know, if you're trying to add exercise, rehab or not, you just do a little bit more every day. And as you get stronger and stronger and stronger, it gets easier and easier and easier. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it gets harder.
Yeah, it's not always a linear progress, but...
No. But over time, you keep doing it, it keeps getting easier.
Yeah. Now, here's another one of those lines that I think you might have been pointing to with Matt's relationship to Tylan has gotten more complicated, because Tom says... Hey, Matt, you're looking a little forlorn without Tylan around. Mm-hmm. And it's like, everything I say about Matt doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about. Matt's a liar, blah, 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 blah. Like, Tom is the best judge of character in the entire cast. And he takes these little bits and pieces of things and puts together the truth. And yes, he has a sense of humor. Yes, he is sarcastic. Yes, he is fallible. But like... He's pointing out something Matt is not conscious of. And it's like, your mood just seems off. Like, I have to believe Tom. Like, I have to. It would be unethical not to believe Tom in this moment. And so I think you're really right that Matt's gotten way more used to and acclimated to Tylan than he could possibly admit until later.
So that brings me to the last page of this chapter.
Yeah.
Just sort of the readout, really.
Yeah. Yeah. There it do be.
We didn't do a read in either, did we?
No, because it was like the in bed dialogue sequence, which is just like you can recite what happens or you can read what happens in a weird Tylan voice. Like, it wasn't a great read in, I don't think. But yeah, there we go.
He spent the rest of the morning pacing, well, limping, up and down the carpet in Tylan's bedchamber, ignoring the pain in his leg while he tried to think of something, anything that would let him carry out the impossible in 2 days. The pain really was less. He had given up the walking stick, pushing himself to regain strength. He thought he might manage 2 or 3 miles on foot without needing to rest his leg. Without resting it very much, anyway. At midday, Julin brought him the only really good news he had heard in an age. It was not news exactly, it was a cloth sack containing 2 dresses wrapped around the silver length of an Adam. So yeah, they finally accomplished one of their goals, and in the next chapter it's pointless.
Yeah. I think they do still need the Adam at least.
Sure.
But yeah, it's
sure.
Julin feels like he put out a lot of risk for very little reward in the end. He's quite frustrated.
Very.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? they're also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
What do you want to do, Chapter 29? Another plan? With the Adam symbol, in which Domon saves Matt's plans, right? As he's thinking that no one will save him?
Yeah, because there's another plan, right? That's the title of this chapter. Another plan comes along, Chapter 29. Because the last one was failing miserably.
Yeah. Yeah. Back to square one, Matt.
Yep. You're going to get a whole bunch of pieces. And to bring them together, you need another plan. It's almost a plan within a plan, because it has echoes of the first plan. It's just, he gets everything he needs from Vail Domon and sort of alters it so that he gets, you know, three existing Suldan to help him out.
Yeah, it's, he gets everything he needed, if not in the way he expected.
So basically, he's pitching this plan to Jolene, and she's like, this is not gonna work, right? Jolene is absolutely convinced that this plan is going to fail, because the plan as it exists is pretty much currently going to fail. There's no way it comes together without an added something.
Yeah, and her resistance to this is not for that reason. Her resistance to it is because she doesn't want to put the thing on.
Sure, sure, sure.
But yeah, it isn't going to work if not for the reasons she thinks.
Her two warders are pretty obviously on her side about this. What was going on with her warders when Jolene has never been captive, right? She's always just been in hiding.
Yeah, they had to smuggle her out of the palace and keep her hidden and all of that stuff. But yeah, the three of them have been
right,
in hiding the whole time.
Because Jolene was unconscious because Teslin slipped her a little something something.
Yeah, a little fork root.
Yeah, a little fork root just to keep her placid while the girls escaped. And that led to her getting captured. Well, not getting captured, but her having the warders sneak her out.
Yeah, her getting trapped in between being captured and being scot-free.
Right, right, right. Being trapped in the city, but not captured by the
right,
Swan Chan.
Exactly. So yeah, she's very unwilling to try this, and her warders are ready to beat Matt up. But Mistress Anan pulls out her Aes Sedai reflexes and is like, sit down, child, and figure this out. They do the experiment. And it fails, despite Jolene's acquiescence, which is very demoralizing for everybody, but particularly for Matt, because that's whose head we're in. We also have this whole interaction with Satala, Anan, and Matt, which is interesting, where she's like, oh yeah, by the way, I absolutely could not stand to continue to live here where slavery is happening. That's just not going to be a thing that I do. And I think that's it's an interesting little, like, subplot of, like, she could choose to stay. So many people are choosing to stay, right? Rizel is choosing to marry into it. A person's willing to buy Satala's inn and continue to operate there. And she's like, I'm morally opposed to the system of enslavement that these people are using. So I'm pulling up stakes and leaving.
Well, and this is where we get a lot of hints that Satala Nan is a former Aes Sedai, right? She is like, I couldn't stay here because of what they're doing to channelers, right? She thinks that Jolene needs to stop acting like a child and, you know, just give it a shot, right? Like, she's just like, perhaps along the way you'll show me that you know what it means to be Aes Sedai. I settled for a glimpse of a grown woman. So far, all I have seen is a novice sniveling in her bed and throwing tantrums, right? So, like, Satala Nan is talking like someone who is an Aes Sedai and is disgusted by the behavior of these so-called Aes Sedai that she's helping, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. She's not impressed with them. But she's also so morally opposed to the Shan Shan that she's like, I'm leaving. I'm leaving entirely. Which, like, Jordan, like, grew up in the South. Like, there's a lot of why do people move? Mm-hmm. What systems are you upholding by where you choose to stay and have your tax dollars and your participation and all of that? And, like, I just wonder how much Jordan is, like, articulating, you know, the decisions people make when they choose to live in slave societies, to live in concentration camps that are exploiting people's labor. Like, people choose to leave sometimes because they find it so disgusting. Mm-hmm. Other people choose to stay and say, oh, this is terrible and I'm going to try to make it better in within the system. Other people are just like, I'm done. I'm not supporting this at all. And it's,
and I think there's a real moral quandary there. Do you stay and try and fix the system from the inside, or do you leave and abandon it and hope it collapses, knowing that you're leaving behind human suffering that will continue on with or without you?
Right, right. Yeah. Is it your duty to stay and fight, or is it your duty to divest? What is going to be more effective for your soul and conscience, for the society as a whole, for the people suffering today, for the people suffering tomorrow? Like, there is no one clear answer. It's just Jordan is very, I think, explicitly articulating this is a conundrum you should think about. Okay. Dun, 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 dun. And don't worry, everyone, I'll be cutting all of that out. It's far too spicy.
Well, let's see. So we find out that all of Satalanon's family has already left on boats. She's the only one who's staying behind.
To help him, because she wants to be part of his party for a bit. But she's like, you can't convince me to bring the boats into the equation because they are 3 days out of port. So...
And of course, Jolene gets the whole, oh, you look familiar to Satalanon, because she was around. Wasn't Jolene a novice under Satalanon back when she was an Aes Sedai?
I believe so. I think so. I think the ages are right. And she also does this thing where she's like, Matt, your plan is dumb. Also, if there's more Aes Sedai to rescue, I demand that you include them in your plan. And it's just like... From unhelpful to unhelpful, Jolene. Goodness.
But yeah, so remember, Stalinan went as Martine Janta. That was her name, as Aes Sedai.
And yeah, Jolene's old enough that mm-hmm. the timing works out that she would have been studying under Satala before she got mm-hmm. instilled.
Right, because Satala was burned out in 75. And Jolene, let's see.
She was raised like decades ago, though. She's had the shawl for a while.
Sure, yeah. Birth 899, so she's like 100. So yeah, she definitely was around 30 years ago when she probably spent decades working with her, actually, and working in the tower at the same time as her.
Yeah.
So the next thing I have is him practicing opening the collar and the bracelet, which I think might be the best description of opening the two of them that we ever get.
Yeah, and I'm so impressed with how good it is, because these are the kind of instructions that are impossible to write and, like, make sense, and mm-hmm. I think RJ does a really good job.
The catches were a simple matter for him. The bracelet, easiest. That was just a matter of squeezing the right spots, top and bottom, not quite opposite the latch. It could be done with one hand, and the bracelets popped open on one with a metallic click. The collar was a little trickier and required both hands. Putting his fingers on the proper spots on either side of where the leash was attached, he pressed, then twisted and pulled while holding the pressure. Nothing happened that he could see until he twisted the two sides the other way. Then they came apart right beside the leash, with a sharper click than the bracelet. Simple. Of course, figuring it out had taken him nearly an hour back in the palace, even with what Julin had seen to help.
He's got clever hands, and it took him an hour to work that out.
Right. Sort of blacksmith's puzzle to the ultimate amount. But because if you think about it, that first movement, nothing changes. And so it's very hard to figure out that you've done that, and then you have to do another movement after that. And so, yeah, I can see where it's sort of like those puzzles where you have to know the solution before you can start, because you have to go in the right direction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or be able to just really systematically try every single combination, which is, I think, what Matt did, is he just has the right kind mm-hmm. of mind that he just was able to just keep fiddling with it until he figured it out. But yeah, like, mm-hmm. it's very, very tricky puzzle.
And of course, it resizes itself to whoever's neck you put it on, which is why it fits Jolene. It's like, he must have been wrong about the size. It's like, no, it's magical.
That's how all the Tarangrial work. They just size themselves to the person. That's like a base mm-hmm. part of the code that all of these jewelry Angrial have.
Yeah, because we saw that with Nynaeve's...
the hand one, the cool hand thing.
The hand one. Yeah, the hand thing. That's part of her paralysis net.
Yeah, and I'm sure that... That might be the only other example, but I'm sure that that's applicable to every piece of jewelry that's meant to be worn in that kind of close-fitting way. I'm sure they all have that in their base code.
So yeah, this is where we get the whole Jolene torture scene that we talked about earlier, where they try and put it on her wrist. They try and put it on Stalinon's wrist, and they both take two steps, and Jolene collapses in pain because Stalinon is an inert doorknob when it comes to the Adam.
Yeah, and that's why we can't just have any woman do the thing.
Mm-hmm.
I, for some reason, had it in my mind that because she was like a burned out channeler, there was I had so many like Ptolemaic level explanations for why this worked, and it's just that she is an inert object as far as the Eidam is concerned. Right. It's very simple,
and it's the description of basically bending over with cramps and, you know, huddling in on herself, her arms and legs and her fingers twitched and crooked at angles. So her muscles are twitching involuntarily combined with cramps, basically, which are also muscles twitching. It just basically freezes you up so you can't move anymore.
Yeah, she's kind of like touching an electric fence. It's just like your whole muscle, whole nervous system just gets hit with a blast of, no, you will not do that. Mm-hmm.
And we like saw Egwene be forced to like crawl across the floor to pick up a cup of water or something, like to prove to her what it would be like to try and escape.
Yeah.
And yeah, I remember that back in Great Hunt, right? There's all sorts of descriptions.
Part of that conditioning that makes you have to need to want the Adam to stay on in order to have it let you have any motion at all. It's all wound into that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, he lies to Stalinon, like, oh, I got a plan. It's fine. It's fine. Mm-hmm. Also, my cloak is definitely not too dull. I do not miss the lace. It's fine. And then he walks upstairs wondering what to do, and Domon Ex Machina saves the day.
Domon, I love that. Domon Ex Machina. It's great. But yeah, so Matt doesn't really... Vail Domon's like, hey, remember me? And Matt's like, not really. That was pretty hazy back, you know... Back before I lost my memory.
Yeah, back when I was Dagger Matt and didn't like anybody. Mm-hmm. I don't actually trust you, person that I met during Dagger Matt phase. And he's like, I'm going to avoid you if I ever get the chance. We should totally meet up sometime, which will never happen. And Domon's like, I know exactly what you're thinking, and I am now putting an arm around your shoulders, so you cannot escape.
Right. Come with me, and you'll see a world of pure imagination. So yeah, Vail Domon basically strong arms him up into their hotel room. Their room at the inn.
They've been living up there ever since, you know, a week ago when they moved in, the day that, you know, Matt met Jolene and all that. Yeah, they got a room and they've been staying there ever since.
And if we go back to Aginen's storyline, they were looking for a ship to escape because she's worried about the Seeker.
Yes.
And so they're trying to find a way out because the Seeker is seeking them because of that whole crazy made-up story that he invented that actually kind of involves Matt and Tom.
Weirdly
enough. And now they're going to Matt and Tom and Julian. It's a very weird coincidence.
It's Severin.
Definitely. It's Severin.
But yeah, because I hadn't thought about how loopy that is, that the nubbin of truth that makes the lies that turns into why they want to leave is also the person who gives them the ability to leave, but couldn't leave without them needing to leave. It's very Taviran, very meta.
And it totally makes the Seeker like feel even more right. Cause he's like, I knew it was a conspiracy.
Who did they go to? They literally go to the,
right.
Of course the Seeker doesn't know to have Tom. Oh no, he does have Tom's name by now. Doesn't he? Mm-hmm. So the Seeker is so bizarrely close to the truth, so close to being right,
and yet so far away from it too. Right,
backwards is all hell.
Just way off.
So yeah, we start to get a little bit of recap exposition plot to bring Matt and Domon back into alignment, because it's like, oh, because he doesn't trust Aegeanon at all, and then she says, "I met Nynaeve and Elaine," and Matt is like, "Well, that changes all my calculations about how much I should give a shit about you and if I should trust you and if I need to engage with you, because what would those two have been doing with you and how does this work?" And then he confirms it with Tom and Julian after the perspective switch, or after the time jump. makes a huge difference. The fact that Egwene had that relationship with Nynaeve and Elaine back in Tanchico is a huge part of how Matt is able to trust her enough to bring her into his party here.
Right, right, absolutely. And of course, Tom and Julin aren't telling him about the Aedom because they were sworn to secrecy that this male Aedom exists. Sorry, the sad bracelets, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and Matt kind of has this moment of realizing that, like, if he doesn't play this argument out the right way, he's going to get his throat slit, which is absolutely true. Mm-hmm. If he says the wrong thing, he is not leaving that room alive. And then he manages to navigate the conversation such that he gets himself 3 Suldam that will keep their mouths shut and help him get out without a problem. He mm-hmm. just he bets it all. He's all in, and right. because he's Matt, he wins.
And of course, she just happens to know 3 Suldam who have been collared and cut off and want out because they realize they're also channelers: Bethamon, Rena, and Sita.
And that, in huge part, is because they made the mistake of capturing Egwene and getting Nynaeve's ire all involved. And, like, again, Nynaeve is the through line for all these pieces.
So Sita and Rena are the 2 that get collared. Bethamon walks in and sees them and then runs away.
And then gets captured by Egwene after, who then discovers, accidentally on her own, that the collar will hold her.
That's right.
Which Bethamon knew already, but, you know, Egwene comes to this information accidentally when she tries to capture Bethamon.
Right. So Egwene is the one who collars Bethamon. The other 2 are collared by Nynaeve and Egwene when she escaped.
Yes. And Bethamon is back in Seanchan because she was let go and didn't know where else to go and went back. But she has the secret and no one knows it, right? No one can blackmail her about that. Like, Rena and Sita are being held in a kind of blackmail limbo state with Suroth and Alwyn. Bethamon is only to herself. She's the only one that knows with respect to herself.
But she's afraid if the Seeker gets a hold of Egwene, her secret will be out. Because Egwene will flip on her, tell the Seeker, and then she's screwed as well.
Right, yeah, because Egwene does know about her, but since she's under Suldam, it wasn't in Bethamon's calculus until the Seeker showed up.
Right, right. So, but that's how she knows she can control these Suldam, is that she's holding over them the fact that they can be collared.
Yes, and she, Egwene also, by saying calmly, oh yes, I can deliver this, she is bullshitting almost as hard as Matt in terms of being calm. Right. She's like, I don't know how I'm going to make that happen, but yes, I can make that happen. So yeah, and then we jump forward a few hours to Matt debriefing with Tom and Julin and telling them that all the work that they finally managed to push through, they got their fetch quest natural 20 at the 11th hour, and we don't need it.
Yeah, too late. I found something better. I have an actual person in the blood who can sign off on these Suldam and Damane, and I have actual Suldam to use, so I don't need the dresses and the collar anymore. Thanks so much.
Kind of reminds me how my great-grandfather spent a good portion of World War II designing an airplane for use in the war, and the war ended right before it went into production.
Kind of reminds me of the 2 years I worked for the Veterans Association Medical Group, programmed a whole new format and testing regimen for certain tests they do. The government paid my company, I think, around $1 million for the work, you know, all including all the admin and everything associated with it. And they threw it away at the end of those 2 years.
Ugh.
Yeah. Yeah, it's frustrating. It's frustrating. It would have been a vast improvement. And instead, they said, instead of improving our current system, we're just going to create a new one.
Man.
Which is going to take another 10 years. Or 5 years, or however long it took.
So you were very much the Julin of that situation.
Yes. That's what I'm trying to say.
You were hurling your code into the corner and then glaring at it for the rest of the meeting.
Yep, exactly. That being said, I do love my current job. It is nice to actually work on machines that make computer chips. There's a lot of cool information. There's a lot of neat science that's happening inside the machines.
For sure. For sure. There's some kind of neat plot happening in the rest of this chapter, a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, what's going on in this POV switch? It's not even a POV switch because it's still Matt. It's a time jump.
It's just a time jump. We've got Julin having some class conflict with Domon, which we've seen before. And, he's a smuggler. And Matt's like, can I trust him or not? And Julin's like, you can trust him, I guess.
It's basically cops and robbers, right? Like,
yeah. And so then Matt's like, all right, well, if we trust everyone, we've got our pieces in place, we're leaving tomorrow. We are blowing this popsicle stand tomorrow. And Julian's like, well, in that case, can I sleep every other night, please? Can we wrap this meeting up? I feel like this could have been an email. And like, I just want to close the Zoom.
I like when Tom starts talking, he blows three perfect smoke rings, one through the other. Just very Gandalf-like
so,
of him.
Yes.
Yeah, just little Tom Merlin. You know, very wizard-like. Yep. It's just sort of the wisdom of that he says. And that's when he shares the fact that Egyanin took the Adam and helped dispose of it, in quotes. Because they don't know she hasn't actually, didn't actually dispose of it yet. Right? So as far as they know, Bail Domon and Egyanin took that thing, dumped it in the ocean, and it is gone forever. Right? Even Julian says, like, why worry about it? That thing's at the bottom of the sea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nope. It's a fatal mistake to assume that that is the thing. Well, not it's only fatal for the bad guys, but it's very nearly fatal for the good guys.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that lets Rand seize the true power for the first time, which is almost a disaster, right? Because that's what makes him almost, that pushes him over the edge to the point of almost destroying the world.
Yeah, and then we get a fun, we get a lot of fun Tom stuff here, because not only does he blow perfect smoke rings, and not only does he tell Julin that sometimes circumstances change and it's important to share information when circumstances change, we also get him giving us a fun little, like, stories have power. And he sort of explains, like, the power that rumor has. I mean, this is what he does, right? Is he pulls rumors together to make truth. And he's like, let me explain to you how rumors can also define truth and tear countries apart. And I love getting to have the master of the craft explaining kind of how the magic works a little bit.
Totally. Yeah, and I love this back and forth between him and Julin, where he's like, Terrence is like Aes Sedai, right, Julin? And Julin's like,
not all tyrants.
Not all tyrants. And Tom turns to him and goes, okay, my Aes Sedai loving tyrant friend. It's like, yeah, right, Aes Sedai lover. You know, that's a slur in Terran form. And he's being like, okay, sure, you love them.
Yeah, right, it's definitely right, a not all tyrants. I'm not like that. None of my friends are like that. And Tom's like, okay, yes, we know. Not all tyrants. Anyway, about the, like, pervasive systemic problems in your country. Yeah, I like their dynamic. Julin says, some of us don't like Aes Sedai, but not many of us have met Aes Sedai, not to know it. The way the law was forbidding channeling, few Aes Sedai came to Tyr, and they very seldom advertised who they were. Black exclusion laws, anybody?
There's a interesting quote about the fog of war that I kind of like here, where Matt's, you know, doing his usual Sun Tzu internal monologue, where he says, a man always tried to make whoever was commanding the troops against him believe that he was doing something other than what he was, that he was going where he had no intention of going, and the enemy tried to do the same to him. If the enemy was any good at the craft, sometimes both sides could get so confused that very strange things happened. Tragedy sometimes. Cities burn that no one had any interest in burning, except that the burners believed what was untrue, and thousands died. Crops destroyed for the same reason, and tens of thousands died in the famine that followed.
Proxy wars.
Proxy wars, fog of war, this idea that you know, go into someplace else and you fight over something that you don't know is necessarily true, but you believe it's true because you've been fed false information. And yeah, you can have just tragedies happen.
Yeah, the entire history of the U.S. versus the world is like summed up in that. Like, oh my God. But it's true because like it happens at the speed of bureaucracy, and it happens at the speed of armies marching. And like, I mean, like one of the weirdest tragedies I've ever heard of is wars that keep getting fought after the people who started it sign a peace accord, right? Like, that is, to me, one of the most weirdly heartbreaking parts of warfare is that, like, at the speed these things happen, you can have literal peace is concluded, and yet people are still killing each other over it. And, like, even with magic communication, I mean, which Matt isn't kicking for, like, it's just... And then you get into propaganda and misinformation, and it just, yeah, cities burn. It's fun to, like... Tom explaining how stories work, having Matt explain how war works. It's cool to have the master character explain the magic, but this is sad magic.
So there's a whole rant about believing things that are untrue, followed by the fact that they think somebody must have told Rand about the male Adam, and it's at the bottom of the sea. Both of which are untrue. Yeah. Like, again, I love the way Jordan layers these things together by talking about untruths and then giving us a couple of untruths. Just, again, very good storytelling. Like, even in some of his slower plot lines, like, the storytelling is still really, really good.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just like, you know, we have this random character and then mention of a listener, and it's like, well, those are connected. They have to be. They have, even without proof, they have to be. Like, you see it here. Like, there's just, he has a beat and then an echo of that beat. And then, yeah, we get to the end of our 10-day montage, and he does an insomnia in Tylan's bed. Which I believe it is correct before a really important day to wake up to just spend all night awake worrying about it. It really helps your performance the next day on that important test when you just spend all night worrying about the test.
Yeah, that always helps me. That's usually, or if I've got like a first day of work, what I usually like to do is just not sleep before it, so I'm at my best. Yeah, just want to make sure, I really want to impress everybody with me falling asleep in the middle of whatever I'm doing.
Clearly, Matt has been listening to us because he's doing the same thing.
But yeah, so he's very anxious. Not so much about the golem, although that would,
he should
that's
be.
What would scare me. He should be, yeah. But really what he's nervous about is the plan of rescuing the girls and how that's all going to come together. I can see it, though, like with the golem, it's like you can only do what you can do. It's kind of out of his control. The plan, on the other hand, he can still make, he's in total charge of all the things that are going to happen, and he can make changes and decide to do something different, right? Like, he doesn't have a lot of options, but he's the one in charge of those options.
Yeah, and that's actually really fair. Like, you know, with the pandemic or with the Cascadia subductions on Earthquake, like, there is only so much acute energy I have for that. At a certain point, it's gonna have to become background noise while I worry about, like, burning the rice or whatever I'm doing. So, yeah, right. He's been living with the golem stressing him out for 10 days, like, he can't help but have it start fading to the back burner.
And it feels like more like a natural disaster, right? It's just like something you respond to when it happens.
It's lightning or a tornado. It'll strike when it does, and you respond at that time. He's got the medallion. He's got his plan. That's his resiliency. He's got the medallion ready to go. But other than that, it's worrying about all the human elements that he needs to orchestrate tomorrow. And will Tylan come back? Spoilers, she will. And like all of that. So, but yeah, it's good for his brain to stay up worrying over things he can't control.
That night, Matt chose to sleep in Tylan's bed. Not for old time's sake. That thought made him laugh, though his laughter had too much of the sound of a whimper to be very funny. It was just that a good feather mattress and goose down pillows were preferable to a hayloft when a man did not know when his next decent night's sleep would come. The trouble was that he could not sleep. He lay there in the dark with an arm behind his head and the medallion leather cord looped through itself on his wrist, ready to hand in case the golem slid through the crack under the door. But it was not the golem that kept him awake. He could not stop going over the plan in his head. It was a good plan, and simple as it could be in the circumstances. Only no battle ever went according to plan, even the best. Great captains earn their reputation, not just for laying brilliant plans, but for still being able to find victory after those plans began to fall apart. So when the first light illuminated the windows, he was still lying there, rolling the medallion across the back of his fingers, and trying to think of what was going to go wrong. Thank you.
And he doesn't anticipate any of the things that actually go wrong. Canonically, he's like, well, that wasn't on my list of things that kept me awake.
Nope. Didn't think that was going to happen.
Well, that was actually a fun two-parter. I'm glad we did that in two parts, because I don't think there was enough in one chapter, but that was good to knock those out together, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there was not quite enough in either, but it was a good, solid chapter when put together. Got us through that little time jump, got us through a bunch of Matt stuff, and very cohesive. It wasn't quite one moment to the next for the chapter break, but it was pretty damn close.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was a bigger time jump in the second chapter than in between the chapters. I almost think that that time jump is probably where the chapter break initially was, and they're like, it's too unbalanced, let's move it back a little bit.
I agree. But, you know, I think we got through some good plot stuff, and we got some good lines from Matt, and some of the tangents were actually quality enough to keep. So,
yeah. And from here on out, we basically are doing one chapter per episode, because the rest of the book starts to actually pick up a little bit. There's quite a bit of action. There's the battle to escape. And then, of course, there's the cleansing. If you don't know, we have altered our plans for the cleansing a little bit. We talked about moving it, and we are going to move it, but what we're going to do is, you realize in the final chapter, there are 20 or so different perspective switches. And what we're going to do is do one perspective with each chapter of the Crossroads of Twilight.
To keep the timeline synced up, so we're not doing flashbacks, we're doing flashovers.
And that way also we'll get one little section about that final battle to cleanse the source to start out each chapter in Crossroads of Twilight. So that'll give us a little pick-me-up before we dig into whatever's going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, and it's going to work out timing-wise, like, almost perfect without us having to do any kind of special footwork. It just, we laid them out and it was like, oh, well, the numbers are
perfect, these match, so. Yeah. There's like 22 chapters, including the prologue, so really we're not going to do one for that. So there's like 21 chapters before the cleansing happens in Crossroads of Twilight, or is over in Crossroads of Twilight, and there are 20 POV switches. So it's almost, you know, and surely we'll combine a couple of those chapters and a couple of those POV switches. So
absolutely.
It works out really well. It almost feels like, you know, it's something we've been thinking about quite a bit, to try and figure out how do we want to address this in a way that's a little more entertaining than just straight through. And I think we found the secret sauce.
Yeah. And I'm sure that the way it was written was great for people reading it, but given how we do spoilers, I'm way more excited to weave these two things together.
And also, I think it's going to help spice up Crossroads.
Yeah. It'll help Crossroads feel like it's going by faster, because we'll actually be consistently reminded about the cleansing rather than having to like hold it as this one chunk of stuff.
And also, because in those chapters we're going to be referencing the cleansing constantly, because that's what's going on in the background, it'll be nice to actually sort of flash between those two. So, yeah, I think it's going to... Because we've talked about for a long time ago how much it would be better if those two books were kind of combined and squished together and sort of chopped up in between. And we're doing the best that we can with what we've got, I think, in a way that's easy to manage, right? Like,
we're editorializing the pacing of the slog is mm-hmm. what's happening.
Totally.
Because we're creatives, mm-hmm. and so we can do that. So, yeah, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and we will see you next week.
See you next week.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Editing Aradia here to say that this next section of the after show is another fairly politically charged IRL discussion section. It isn't quite as long-winded or as disconnected from the books this time, but still. If you would like to only come to the podcast for escapism, then now would be the time to hop off. All right. Thanks.
And I feel like that applies a lot in our current day in politics. We have a lot of people moving to places where they are around other people who share their politics, whether that's, you know, and people are self-sorting into more liberal central cities and more conservative rural areas for the most part. I know you're an exception to that one.
There's a lot of exceptions. There are so many liberal people who are being trapped by the bias between the rural. I mean, the rural-urban divide is a huge tool for the culture war. It's awful, actually, how much people are like in, you know, oh, they're in Texas, so they deserve what they get. And it's like,
right.
No. But it is a problem. Like, one of the podcasters I know that's really cool, she decided she was done living in Oregon. She's like, I'm a black woman who's lived here for a bunch of my life, and I'm done. I'm just done. Like, she's just over it. And I'm here like, yeah, I gotta make it somewhere that isn't making people be done. You know, like,
Oregon has a really bad history around its racial reckoning.
Uniquely and bad, even.
Yeah, it's really, really bad. It's kind of worse than almost any other state out there, especially in you know, the 1950s era.
Yeah. So it's like, some of us really, it's ridiculous for us to run away. It's like, oh, I don't want to be a racist person. I'm going to run away to Canada, which is famously not racist in the slightest. Right? Like, you know, but then there's also like, some people need to run away because it's traumatizing to stay, right? Satala is leaving because she has a stake in the channeler's experience. And like, that's going to be too difficult for her. This podcaster I know is like, I'm done being racially traumatized by being in Oregon.
Which is so funny, because I've had, you know, my trainer just quit and moved to Texas because he was sick of how liberal and how open and how, you know, how much Oregon was doing to help people who weren't rich white assholes. I'm summarizing, but you know, he'd go on rants about how the taxes he paid that were being used to, you know, help freeloaders in the system and all that kind of stuff, you know. So it's interesting to see both sides of that when, you know, people are saying, I'm leaving Oregon because it's too liberal and because it's too conservative at the same time. Well, conservative, I guess more racist is probably the issue, but
I wish that conservative and racist didn't deserve to be synonyms, but from where I'm sitting right now, do better.
But I think my problem is that there is a lot of liberal racism in Oregon.
That's not just your problem. That's all of the black people's problem. They're like, right, this nice white problem. Northern liberal racism is more toxic and corrosive and soul crushing than the open hatred that you find in the South. This is something I've heard over and over again, is that Northern racism, which is at its peak in Oregon and Washington, is the most corrosive and culture destroying variety. If you just like have straight up hate, it's like, well, at least we can avoid that and work with that. But this, like, I'm being so nice to you, also I'm twisting a knife into your face, be grateful, is right. Just like, it's a lot.
It's almost harder to deal with, but I mean, again, I don't know.
No, you do. You are absolutely hitting the nail on the head. It is a thing that I'm sure Sean Chan will get around to in Ebu Dar eventually. But I don't think that they've quite have that level of entrenched bullshit yet. But they probably do at home. There's probably a state somewhere in the Pacific Northwest of Sean Chan that has this exact problem, going all the way back to the first invasion of Luther Pandrak.
Right, because there's a native population of Sean Chan, and then there's the invaders that came with Luther Pandrak, right?
Oh.
And I feel like that's where the division between the blood and everybody else comes from. The blood are descended from Luthar Pendrag.
Because we love a good caste system in our empires. It's the only way empires work, actually, is to have a caste system.
Yep.
Black exclusion laws, anybody? I'm in Oregon and I can't be racist because I haven't really actually met that many black people. They just don't seem to come around. Just, it's the way the laws are. You know, it's not racism. It's just the way the laws were written, that they get lashed every 6 months if they don't leave. So I mean, we don't hate them.
They're just not around.
Yeah.
For some reason that I have no idea about. Yeah. Yeah. I will just say that there might be a slight reason to dislike the Aes Sedai, though, with the use of their power and all that kind of stuff.
The magic blowing things up with their minds is an extra factor.
I'm just saying.
They have this whole, like, giant fortress with, like, a prophetic magic item inside it that's, like, part of the end of the world and guarding. It's kind of part of their national identity. Like, it is a little different. But also, like, you're protecting your national identity by being xenophobic. Where have I heard that one before?
It's not even xenophobic because, you know, anyone inside, I'd almost say channeling is a better analogy for being gay than being a minority, because anyone can have a child who's a channeler.
I mean, yeah, you're a minority in either scenario.
Right, 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 right.
But yeah.
But it's like, we can, you know, there are, right, like, Suwon is a Terran.
Yeah, well, I mean, think about it like being disabled, right? In a society that punishes you for not being able. Like, anyone can become disabled at any time. Like, down a couple of stairs, and now suddenly you need a wheelchair ramp everywhere. And isn't it inconvenient that they don't exist, right? That you can get that from anywhere. And your society is just like, don't. But yeah, no, Aes Sedai are... there are reasons to maybe just be like no tolerance to Aes Sedai. If you see them like, you know, as the epitome of all evil. Like, zero tolerance has its place when people are truly evil, right? Like, tolerating fascism generally is a slippery slope, right? Like, maybe if they see Aes Sedai in the same kind of absolutist terms, like...
Like the White Cloaks do?
Yeah, and the White Cloaks are famous for being rational and only doing good things with their logic. So...
That's why Gala joined them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to the Wheel of Time Spoilers podcast. Rate us in the Apple Podcast app or support us on Patreon. Is that good enough?